For the first 4 weeks of our journey through the book of Exodus, we have covered essentially three chapters. That's it. Now, some of you know Exodus is 40 chapters long, and we're going to cover the book of Exodus in 12 weeks. So we're going to have to pick up the pace a little bit as we go on. And we're going to do that today by covering all of Exodus 5 through 10. Six chapters in one morning in about 35, 40 minutes. And if you're like, I don't know how you're going to do that, we'll see how it goes. We have so far in the book of Exodus covered that Exodus begins with a family, the family that's been chosen by God, the family that he's going to give blessing to so that they can be a blessing to the world. And this family that started in a small number, the beginning of Exodus, has grown to be a large nation of millions of people. And Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, got worried about them and their power that they had by sheer number, and decided that he would put them in slavery to try and minimize their influence. And then he decided that he would start killing the Hebrew boys that were born by throwing them into the Nile River to minimize their numbers. And it was into that situation that Moses was born. And really by a miracle, he was raised by Pharaoh's daughter. He was raised as a prince of Egypt. He was royalty. He had affluence. He had many earthly comforts. But somehow, deep down within him, he recognized that he wasn't actually an Egyptian. He was an Israelite. So one day he goes out and he notices an Egyptian is beating on a Hebrew man. And he gets angry about it, so angry that he kills the Egyptian man and then hides that Egyptian in the sand. Well, Pharaoh, the king of the land, finds out about it and he's not happy. And so Moses flees 300 miles to a land called Midian, where he starts a whole new life. He gets married, he has children, he starts working as a shepherd for his father-in-law. And it's in that point, 40 years later, at 80 years old, that God shows himself to Moses in the form of a burning bush. And that's in Exodus 3, and that's the account that we read last week, which covers Exodus 3 and 4. Well, after this encounter between Moses and God, we could continue on in chapter 4, and we would see that really God is inviting Moses to be the leader of the Israelite people, to take them out of slavery, out of Egypt, and into a place of freedom. And it says that he is, at the end of chapter 4, inviting Moses to go to Pharaoh and to say, "Let my people go." And that phrase, "let my people go," has become kind of a rallying cry of liberation throughout the history of the world, even ever since Exodus. It was a phrase that was used by people who were revolting against the Catholic Church during the Reformation. It was a phrase used during the American Revolution as these colonies were revolting against English law and rule. And it was a phrase also used by black slaves during the American slave trade. Even a slave song called "Go Down Moses," which used those words, "Let my people go." It's become a battle cry of liberation, of deliverance by people throughout the years. And the question that we're going to get to today is, how does that story play out in Exodus itself? Back in 2016, the word of the year was a hyphenated word called post-truth. It rose to popularity in usage during the presidential election between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, in part because both sides viewed the other as manipulating the truth to their own gain. Here's how one dictionary defines post-truth. It is a situation in which people are more likely to accept an argument based on their emotions and beliefs rather than one based on facts. In other words, post-truth is a term that describes our society's willingness to believe lies, essentially, or at least to believe a distortion of the truth when it benefits our own internal emotions and beliefs. It reinforces those things. And you see this in the way that we deal with news and news information that's given to us. Only 32% of Americans believe that news organizations provide information to us that is fully, accurately, and fairly presented. Only 1 in 3 Americans think that we can trust the news that is given to us by news organizations. And without this kind of common ground of information that we can rely on as truthful to help inform us about life and the happenings of our world, we're left to our own devices. We look internally. If that feels good, if that makes sense to me, it's therefore true. And if I don't like it, and it doesn't reinforce the preconceived notions I have about life in our world, then I reject it as not being true. It has nothing to do with facts and everything to do with our own internal drive. It's why some of us could come to the conclusion that country music is good, which is absolutely not a factual statement. But some of you believe it. Now, I know I came in there a little hard here at the beginning with a harsh statement, but it's really true. Some of you believe that. Okay, I'll lay off. I'll lay off. As it relates to our story in Exodus, we are today having to wrestle with how do we deal with truth when truth shows himself to be the truth? How will we respond? When God, who is the truth, shows himself to be truth, how do we respond? So last week we looked at God and Moses and their interaction and God's invitation to partner with him to bring about deliverance for the Israelite people out of Egypt. And one of Moses' concerns was that he wasn't going to be able to speak well enough. And God says, well, hey, I'll give you a partner. And so Moses' brother, Aaron, comes and travels to see Moses, and Moses tells about all that God has told him. And then they partner up, and they go to the elders of Israel, and they tell them all about God that's done, and they're all excited. And so Moses and Aaron then go to Pharaoh. And I just want to set this all up with two verses in chapter 5. Two verses in Exodus 5, verses 1 and 2, which talk about this first interaction that Moses has with Pharaoh. It says, afterward, Moses and Aaron, after they had met with the elders of the Israelites, they went to Pharaoh and said, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go so that they may hold a festival to me in the wilderness. Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go. Now, the significance of what's written about in just those two verses is a little hard to understand without having immediately just read Exodus 3 and 4 before it. Because what we would see is that Moses is still not fully obedient to God. One of the things, the instructions that God gave Moses was that he was to take the elders of Israel to Pharaoh to make this declaration. But who goes? Moses and Aaron. So he doesn't take the right people. And then another instruction from God is that he wants Moses to go to Pharaoh and say, I'm asking for 3 days in the wilderness. But Moses doesn't ask for 3 days. He just asked for time in the wilderness, an indefinite period of time. And so what we see Moses doing here is he's brought the wrong people and made the wrong ask before Pharaoh. He asked for way too much in the wrong way, and Pharaoh does not respond favorably to this. He's angry and frustrated. You can read the rest of chapter 5. He decides that he's going to make things even harder for the Israelites in their slavery. He says, I'm going to give you less straw, and I'm going to demand that you make more bricks. In other words, I'm going to make things miserable for you because you've asked me to do something that I simply do not want to do. And we could summarize all of his attitude toward what Moses has said in verse 2. His response, he says, who is the Lord? That's kind of a summary of his response. And how will Pharaoh respond to this idea of God presenting himself is really the story that plays out from Exodus 5 all the way through Exodus 14 and the deliverance story that we'll read about on Easter Sunday. This is a key question. Who is the Lord? And the passage that we're going to read is really God's way of answering that question. Who is the Lord? And so we'll pick up the story at the very end of chapter 6, chapter 6, verse 28, and then we're going to read half of chapter 7. And then later on this morning, we'll read the second half of chapter 7. So we're at Exodus 6, verse 28. Now, when the Lord spoke to Moses in Egypt, he said to him, "I am the Lord. Tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, everything I tell you." But Moses said to the Lord, "Since I speak with faltering lips, why would Pharaoh listen to me?" Then the Lord said to Moses, "See, I have made you like God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron will be your prophet. You are to say everything I command you, and your brother Aaron is to tell Pharaoh to let the Israelites go out of his country. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I multiply my signs and wonders in Egypt, he will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt, and with mighty acts of judgment, I will bring out my divisions, my people, the Israelites. And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the Israelites out of it." Moses and Aaron did just as the Lord commanded them. Moses was 80 years old and Aaron 83 when they spoke to Pharaoh. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "When Pharaoh says to you, 'Perform a miracle,' then say to Aaron, 'Take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh, and it will become a snake.'" So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and did just as the Lord commanded. Aaron threw his staff down in front of Pharaoh and his officials, and it became a snake. Pharaoh then summoned wise men and sorcerers, and the Egyptian magicians also did the same things by their secret arts. Each one threw down his staff, and it became a snake. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. This is the word of the Lord, at least part one of what we'll be looking at. And as we begin our showdown between God and Pharaoh, one interesting thing to note is that this is a different Pharaoh than the Pharaoh we read about in Exodus 1 and 2. It says at the end of chapter 2 of Exodus that Pharaoh died and a new king came to power. In other words, a new Pharaoh. But notice that nowhere in Exodus are we given the name of either of these pharaohs, only their title. And it's kind of the Bible's way of diminishing the significance of Pharaoh. But then it also reminds us that Pharaoh is functioning as what we described as the serpent king. He's playing a role. And in Exodus 9, it even describes to Pharaoh himself God's idea of the role that Pharaoh will play. In verse 16, it says, "I have raised you up for this very purpose." What is that purpose? "That I might show you my power and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth." The entire point of Pharaoh's existence, according to God and his description here, is that Pharaoh is a pawn in the story that God is telling. He is the serpent king. And this draws us back all the way to Genesis 3, where God said that I will crush the serpent's head. And so Pharaoh, functioning like the serpent of Genesis 3, is God's way of foreshadowing his ultimate victory over the serpent. And so what we see in the passage that we just read around Moses and around Pharaoh as the serpent king is that God's plan is moving forward. On our very first Sunday going through Exodus, we talked about how God's plan was continuing forward, and that continues even here in chapter 7 as well. He says in verses 4 and 5, "I will lay my hand on Egypt, and with mighty acts of judgment, I will bring out my divisions, my people, the Israelites, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the Israelites out of it." Despite Moses not being fully obedient to God and not exactly following God's instructions, he says to Moses, "I will still deliver the people." And this then is followed by the first of many miraculous signs and wonders that God displays in front of Pharaoh. And he has a purpose for all of these. In fact, the purpose is mentioned 7 times during all of these signs and wonders. And it's meant to really provide an answer to Pharaoh's question back in chapter 5. Who is the Lord? 7 times God states his purpose in answering that question. He's going to answer the question of who the Lord is through signs and wonders. And then it says, so that you will know, Pharaoh, so that they will know, Egypt, so that they will know the entire world, that this God is the one true ruler of all. And it's this repetition that helps us see that this is a key theme in the book of Exodus, that the story is not ultimately about Moses taking on Pharaoh or about the Israelites taking on Egypt or even necessarily God taking on Pharaoh. This is a story about God displaying his power over Satan and evil. And he's displaying his power in a variety of ways. And it's really answering this question of who is sovereign and in control and on the throne over everything. Is it Pharaoh? Is it Egypt? Or is it God, the God of the Israelites? That's this theme that continues to come up over and over again in the book of Exodus. And the first sign and wonder that God shows to Pharaoh is that he turns Aaron's staff into a snake, a serpent, right before Pharaoh. And it's actually kind of a humorous way of displaying his power. One of the things that historians teach us is that Pharaoh's crown was thought to be the head of an angry serpent. And so by Aaron throwing down his staff and God turning it into a serpent, that serpent that then devours the other serpents that the magicians are able to recreate as well, shows that God is saying, I am not only over you, but I'm going to destroy you. In that one simple display. And how will Pharaoh react to this? Will he just immediately go along with it? Well, we have to continue the story. Continue the story in verse 13 of chapter 7, which says this, yet Pharaoh's heart became hard, and he would not listen to them, just as the Lord had said. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is unyielding. He refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he goes out to the river. Confront him on the bank of the Nile and take in your hand the staff that was changed into a snake. Then say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has sent me to say to you, let my people go so that they may worship me in the wilderness. But until now, you have not listened. This is what the Lord says. By this you will know that I am the Lord. With the staff that is in my hand, I will strike the water of the Nile, and it will be changed into blood. The fish in the Nile will die, and the river will stink. The Egyptians will not be able to drink its water. The Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron, take your staff and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over the streams and canals, over the ponds, and all the reservoirs, and they will turn to blood. Blood will be everywhere in Egypt, even in vessels of wood and stone. Moses and Aaron did just as the Lord had commanded. He raised his staff in the presence of Pharaoh and his officials and struck the water of the Nile, and all the water was changed into blood. The fish in the Nile died, and the river smelled so bad that the Egyptians could not drink its water. Blood was everywhere in Egypt, but the Egyptian magicians did the same things by their secret arts. And just a quick aside here, I think it's interesting that it describes the Egyptians as being able to recreate this act of turning water into blood. And if you read the second plague in chapter 8, they're able to recreate the plethora of frogs that overtake Egypt. And why it's interesting to me is like they're taking water and turning it to blood, but there's already blood everywhere. And they're birthing more frogs, but there's already frogs everywhere. Like, wouldn't it have been more impressive if they were able to change the blood back to water and get rid of all the frogs? Like, all they're really doing is just making a problem worse by adding more of the blood and more of the frogs. Anyway, I just thought that was interesting and not all that impressive. So they recreated by their secret arts, and Pharaoh's heart became hard. He would not listen to Moses and Aaron, just as the Lord had said. Instead, he turned and went into his palace and did not even take this to heart. And all the Egyptians dug along the Nile to get drinking water because they could not drink the water of the river. This is the Lord, part two. In this passage, we read the first of what are considered the 10 plagues that God brings on Pharaoh in Egypt. We read the first, and if you were to read all the way through chapter 10 of Exodus, you would read 8 more plagues. The first 9 all read very similarly. They have a very similar framework. They use similar phrases, have similar responses, and are all kind of fit within the same idea. But the 10th plague reads very differently and is far more significant because it's utilized by Jesus and many of the New Testament writers in describing Jesus as the Messiah. And so next Sunday, we're going to spend the whole time looking at the 10th plague, the Passover lamb with the blood on the doorpost that provides deliverance for the people. The first 9 all read similarly enough, and what they all really show is God's power is on display. God's power is on display, and it's summarized here in verse 20 that we just read. Moses and Aaron did just as the Lord had commanded. He raised his staff in the presence of Pharaoh and his officials and struck the water of the Nile, and all the water was changed into blood. There are a lot of opinions from Bible scholars and theologians about why the plagues came about why there were 10 of them, and what the significance of each of the 10 were. One of the things that many scholars believe is that God chose these specific 10 because they were a way of showing his power over and above other Egyptian gods that were worshipped and celebrated in Egypt at the time. For instance, the first plague of turning the Nile River into blood was showing God's power over the Egyptian god named Hapi, Hapi with an I. Over the Egyptian god Hapi, which was thought to be the Egyptian god for the Nile River. The Egyptians at this time were what we would call a pantheistic society. That was their worldview. Pantheistic meaning they saw manifestations of God in created things. So God was in the river. God was in the frogs. God was in the livestock. And God is sending these plagues into these specific things. Like the second plague of the frogs is the Egyptian god Heket, which was thought to be this god of fertility that had the head of a frog. And so when God sends this plague of frogs all over the land, none of the people wanted to kill any of the frogs because they saw the frog as Heket, the Egyptian god of fertility. To kill that god would be to lose out on the opportunity to have a fertile and strong life. So that's one of the ways that we can understand the plagues. And this first plague, the plague of the Nile River being turned into blood, is really interesting to me because God is using Pharaoh's own river of death against him. He used the Nile River to be the river that would kill the Israelite boys, and it's now being turned against him, and that river that he wanted to bring death is now bringing death upon him. It's God's foreshadowing of all that's about to come if Pharaoh will not give in. The first 9 plagues have this purpose and unification to them. But one of the ways I wanted to put it together to make it a little easier to understand and see some of the themes that come out is with a table that would break them down into 3 sets of 3. In the first 3 plagues, we have God over the land and sea, the water becoming blood, the frogs and the gnats, which was probably mosquitoes. Plagues 4 through 6, God over the flesh. This is flies, which is probably horse flies. And the reason why it's God displaying his power over the flesh is horse flies. Male horse flies would go after vegetation like plants and leaves. Female horse flies had sharp teeth that were able to burrow into skin and then suck blood. I know it's rather disgusting, but they would do that to livestock and even humans. And so that's why it's God's display over the flesh. And then you have the livestock plague and the boils on skin. And then plagues 7 through 9 is God over the sky. You have hail coming from the sky. You have locusts, which seem like they're coming out of the sky. And you have darkness that comes over the land. And I know it's rather pointless, but I was thinking about this week. Like, how long could you go if you were Pharaoh before you finally gave in? Like, which plague would be your undoing? And I was thinking about this, and I thought, well, if the gnats were mosquitoes, then that's when I would tap out. And I know you Oregonians don't fully understand the power of a mosquito swarm. But I grew up in Minnesota, and I remember camping out in the wilderness by a lake in Minnesota, which was just overrun with mosquitoes around dusk. And I tell you what, once dusk hit, like, you're just in the tent. There is nothing else. There is no amount of bug spray or anything like that that could keep the mosquitoes away. So you could literally just, like, run around and keep them from biting you, so you're always moving, or you just go in the tent. And then you get in the tent so quickly, and you're, like, watching the mosquitoes fly around and figuring out how you're going to kill the ones that got in the tent so you don't go to sleep and they're still in there and wake up with mosquito bites all over you. So anyway, I know it's rather pointless and just rather humorous, but how long would you go? Which is the plague that would be your demise? For me, it's number three. The point that I want to draw us to in looking at the plagues in this way, organizing them in this way, and seeing these specific themes of God over land and sea, of flesh, God over sky, is to draw us into one of the reasons why I think God provided the plagues in this way is it's meant to show an undoing of creation in Genesis 1. Think about the way that God creates in Genesis 1. First, it says that God separates the sea from the sky. And then he separates the land from the sea. And then God creates vegetation, and he creates animals, and then ultimately he creates us. And you see all three of those specific things in the way the plagues come about: land and sea, flesh and sky. And what I think God is trying to show the Egyptian people is that when God lets his hand off the thing that he had made, it begins to fall apart, and chaos reigns. Water and blood come together. Darkness and light are no longer separated, and chaos takes over. He's showing the people that it's his hand that upholds the creation that he's made, and when he lets go, things fall apart. It's a story of decreation, where the created order is rolled backwards. And we think, like, look at all of the negative things that are happening to the nation of Egypt and even to Pharaoh himself. The natural response is just do what God wants, right? But that's not what Pharaoh does. In fact, it says, but Pharaoh's heart is hard. Verse 13 of Exodus 7. Yet Pharaoh's heart became hard, and he would not listen to them, just as the Lord had said. Pharaoh's hard heart, described all throughout this account of Exodus 4 all the way into chapter 14, is easily, in my viewpoint, the most difficult and controversial part of the book of Exodus as a whole. There's other parts that are difficult to understand and to read, but this, to me, comes to the top. The reason why is there's 20 times in the book of Exodus that it's mentioned that Pharaoh's heart is hard. 10 of those times, it mentions it as a matter of fact or something that Pharaoh willfully, with his own autonomy, chose. But 10 other times, it describes it as something that God did. It even says here in verse 3 of chapter 7, which we read earlier, God says, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And the question that it forces us to wrestle with is whether we and Pharaoh have free will, or if God is orchestrating everything and in control of everything that we do and seemingly choose. And then the question beyond that is, if that's true, if God is in control of everything and everything that he does is controlled by him, then the negative things that are coming through Pharaoh are ultimately God's doing. And so then God, how could he be good if he's causing all of this evil? It forces us to wrestle with all of these sort of questions. And I think the most important way to view this, to be able to try and understand it, is to look at the order in which all of this takes place. In plagues 1 through 5, in chapters 7 through 10, those first five plagues. Every time it mentions Pharaoh's heart, it either describes it as hard or it describes it as Pharaoh choosing his hard heart to be hardened toward the Lord. It's not until the sixth plague and after that that it's written about that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. I think of it as very similar to Romans 1. Romans 1 describes the people of Paul's day as being disobedient and choosing things that are sinful and walking away from the Lord. And in Romans 1:24, it says, "Therefore God gave them over to the sinful desires of their hearts." That seems to be what's happening here with Pharaoh, is that he made a choice and God gave him over to that choice. Here's how one Bible scholar on Exodus describes Pharaoh's heart. He says, "There is no suggestion in Exodus 4 through 14 that God secretly influenced Pharaoh's will or forced a stubborn resolution, which otherwise was incompatible with Pharaoh's basic nature and disposition." Ironically, God actually helps Pharaoh fulfill his desire to remain in control of the Israelites. When God stiffens Pharaoh's heart, he merely strengthens the king's resolve to do what he had already chosen to do. God gave him over to the thing that he ultimately desired and let him pursue that. And I think what we see at work here with Pharaoh and the way that it plays out, there is a spiritual truth that exists for you and I. That when God's presence draws near to our lives in a variety of ways, sometimes it pulls us in. And sometimes we push away. A word picture that would describe this: the same sun that melts the wax can harden clay. When God's presence draws near to us, at times we think, "Yes, Lord, I need more of you." And at other times we say, "You know what? I don't want to be obedient to that. That's not for me. Nope." And we push him away. Jesus even describes the response of the people to him similarly. He says in John 8, "Because I speak the truth, you do not believe me." And so what the Pharaoh's response reminds us often of our own response. And think about our post-truth society, which says it's my feelings and my beliefs that I view the lens of what is true. We reject any sort of external authority that makes claims on our lives about how we're supposed to live and act and be, because we're living for ourselves. And here is God who's come to Pharaoh and made himself known, who's shown his glory, and Pharaoh's heart just pushes it away. And I don't think he's all that different from us either. And the result of him pushing God away is chaos, and evil is reigning all around Pharaoh's life. And isn't that often the case in our lives when we push God away? Chaos and evil begin to reign in and around our lives. Last Sunday, during the baptisms that we had in the back right after we were done meeting in here, one of the themes that I noticed from the six who were baptized as they shared is that it was a life change or a life difficulty that resulted in God coming near to them in a new, in a fresh way. And it could have been that God had tried at many points in their lives to make himself known and draw near to them, but the response, for a variety of reasons, was to push God away and do things for themselves on their own. But eventually, they saw God drawing near, even through immensely difficult things, as an opportunity to draw near to the Lord as he drew near to them. And that same sort of response is available to us every day, all the time. As God makes himself known, will we obey? Will we listen? Will we receive? Or will we choose our own way? The book of Hebrews even talks about the Israelite people in the story of Moses. And it says in chapter 3, "Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as you did in rebellion." I think that's the opportunity for us as we consider our own hearts and our own lives. Is there a little bit of Pharaoh in us that hardens our hearts and pushes away the presence of God to pursue our own things in our own way? And the great news and the amazing truth that's displayed all throughout the book of Exodus, as we see hard hearts in Pharaoh and others, is that God's persistence of us outruns our hard hearts. It goes beyond us and continues to seek after us, even after so many times that we have pushed the Lord away. Jesus makes a truth claim over us and invites a response. He says in John 14, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." And my question to you is, how do you respond to that truth claim? Is your heart soft toward the Lord, willing to receive what he has done and what he longs to do for you and in you? Or is your response more like Pharaoh, a hard heart that wants to do things your own way in your own time? I think in our post-truth society, we're a lot more like Pharaoh than we often imagine ourselves to be. And I think the invitation of the plagues story in Exodus is to open ourselves to the Lord. And so before we respond with communion and with the worship team, I just want to spend a moment praying. And I want to invite you to do something that's a little bit vulnerable. And I want to invite you, as we pray, just to open your hands and to place them in your lap like this before the Lord. And I say this not because this is some magic formula, like now God hears your prayer and now your heart's like automatically open. No, this is a posture change meant to just simply open ourselves to the Lord more than we were before. There's something about praying like this instead of having our arms crossed that opens ourselves to the Lord. So would you join me in prayer? God, as we think about this topic of hard hearts, I'm just immediately drawn to the promise of the new covenant in the book of Ezekiel, which says, "You will replace our heart of stone and give us a heart of flesh." And God, I recognize in myself, I recognize in us as believers, I recognize in the world that there is often a heart of stone that exists within me and within us, where I seek my own way and my own timing, not being willing to listen and to seek and to follow you. As your children, you have forgiven us. You have declared us as righteous. You have already given us some of what you have promised, the gift of eternal life through Christ. You have given us so much. You've brought us from death to life, and yet our heart is still not fully perfected as it will be in eternity. And so I view this kind of image of a heart of stone becoming a heart of flesh as not just a metaphor, but a miracle that we long to be continuing to happen in our hearts and in our lives. We long for the day when our heart will beat for the glory of Christ for eternity. But for now, we fight against that heart of stone and that hard heart that often seeks its own way in its own time. And we're inviting you, through your Son Jesus, the way, the truth, and the life, to remake us, to make us into the kinds of people you want us to be. Soft hearts, willing to receive, heart of flesh, willing to listen and to obey. Would you speak to us? Would you remind us of who we are? Would you do a transformative work of softening our hearts toward you? We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.